Welcome to the Two Cities Podcast, a podcast about theology, culture, and discipleship. And this is episode 222. In this episode, we're talking about gospel media with Dr. Nicholas Elder. Dr. Nicholas Elder is Associate Professor of New Testament at the University of Dubuque Theological Seminary and the author of the book that we're excited to talk about in this episode, Gospel Media, Reading, Writing, and Circulating Jesus Traditions, published by Erdmans. Team members on the episode from the two cities include me, Dr. John Anthony Dunn. So this conversation with Dr. Elder was really rich and enjoyable for me. His book is very stimulating, and it's really interesting to think about the gospel as different kinds of media and to think through the implications of that. We have a wide-ranging conversation about each of the four gospels and the nature of the kind of media that they are and how that affects other questions within gospel scholarship. What Dr. Elder does in his book, Gospel Media, is really walk through a number of myths that people have about how ancient readers read, how ancient writers composed, and how texts were circulated and published in antiquity. It's just really illuminating and fascinating. And of course, the payoff is how this pertains to how we think about the Gospels, the way that they were read, written, and circulated. And if you haven't already, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. And if you appreciate what we do here at the Two Cities, you can follow us on Patreon as well. You can find us on X, Facebook, Instagram, or visit us at our website at thetwocities.com. And with that, here's our conversation with Dr. Nicholas Elder. Well, Dr. Elder, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm really excited to talk about your new book, Gospel Media. As a way to get going, how about in brief, what's the book about? What's the thesis? What are you trying to argue?
Yeah, so the book situates the Gospels within cultures of reading, writing, and circulating or publishing text in Greco-Roman antiquity and in Second Temple Judaism. So the sort of basic idea is that all of those activities, reading, writing, and circulation of text, happened in really complex kinds of ways. There was no one way to read a text. There was no one way to write a text. There was no one way to circulate or publish a text in those contexts. And that we should expect the same to be true of the Gospels, that they were not all read the same way, that they were not all written the same way, and that they were not all circulated the same way. And so the book sort of addresses a variety of what I call media myths with respect to how these things happened and attempts to present a more sort of complex and complicated reality in place of those myths.
Hmm. And how does this book relate to your published dissertation with the Library for New Testament Studies? Is it an extension, a popularization? How would you describe that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So my dissertation was a comparison of one gospel, namely the Gospel of Mark, with the Hellenistic Jewish narrative, Joseph and Asenath, which, you know, if you haven't read this text before, it's a fascinating, fascinating story that it's sort of fan fiction on the patriarch Joseph and how his wife Asenath, who shows up for two verses in the book of Genesis, how they got together, essentially, and how she converted converted to Judaism. And I say converted in scare quotes there. But by most counts, the Gospel of Mark and this Hellenistic Jewish text, Joseph and Asenath, are very, very different. In my dissertation, which became a published book in the Library of New Testament Studies, I argue that despite their theological differences, their generic differences, that the language and style of the Gospel of Mark and Joseph and Asenath are very, very similar to one another. My thesis in the dissertation was that they are similar to one another because they were composed similarly. When we tell stories aloud, when we speak stories, we have sort of one register or style and a very different register and style when we write stories. So there's been a great deal of sociolinguistic work, modern sociolinguistic work, that directly compares the way that we tell stories aloud and the way that we write stories. And what I found was that these differences mapped really, really well onto the similarities between Mark and Joseph and Osenath, and then how different later editors changed Mark and Joseph and Osenath respectively. So in the case of Mark, of course, how Matthew and Luke change Mark. And then in the case of Joseph and Osenath, how different later authors sort of expanded and changed and edited the language of Joseph and Osenath to make it read a little bit better, sort of improved the grammar, as it were. So Gospel Media, in some ways, continues that line of work with respect to the Gospel of Mark. I still very much believe that the Gospel of Mark is sort of primarily composed in an oral sort of dictation kind of mode. But then it expands, this book expands the purview to include the other canonical Gospels and does not suggest that they were composed the same way. But because there were a number of different ways one could write in antiquity, that Matthew, Luke, and John were composed differently than was the Gospel of Mark.
Right. Yeah. And in your new book, you address a number of myths as it relates to reading, writing, and circulating book media, gospel media, like all kinds of stuff. And I'm curious, I'm guessing as a result of working on this dissertation, you realized that there was a lot of rubbish out there in the literature. And at some point you said, you know, I need to write a book to respond to all of this stuff. I'm curious, when you sought to write this, are there particular trends in these myths that are noticeable? Like, you know, what perpetuates these myths? Is it bad scholarship that just doesn't get looked at more closely? Or are there any kind of like apologetic or theological, you know, motivations behind them?
Yeah, I see maybe two roots of these trends. One is, I wouldn't call it necessarily sloppy scholarship, but I would it's more of a repetition of claims that just get made without looking to the primary source evidence. So very, very often in this book, I cite Paul Achtemeyer's, it was a Society of Biblical Literature presidential address called Omne Verbum Sonat, the New Testament and the Oral Environment of Late Western Antiquity. And in this presidential address that then became a Journal of Biblical Literature article, Dr. Achtemeyer makes a lot of these claims, a lot of the claims that I sort of refute in the book. So in some ways, and I've heard this from some reviewers before, that in some ways this book is a refutation of a single SBL presidential address or a single single JBL article. But because, you know, Dr. Achtemeyer was a giant in our field, we are forgiven for sort of going regularly citing this article that presents some very good information and turned the tides in how we think about particularly reading in the ancient world. It did important work in the moment that it was published. But things are more complicated than Dr. Achtemeyer led on. So I think that article in particular and its influence is one reason why many of these myths get often repeated, because you have the standing of a giant behind them, as it were. The other, I think, is that has to do with sort of the othering of persons in antiquity, that we tend to think of the ancient world as wholly different and people in the ancient world as wholly different than us in the modern world. And that is, you know, in some ways absolutely true, that people in the ancient world were different than us. They lived in a different time and place with different media, with different, all kinds of different things. But at the same time, at the end of the day, we haven't changed that much in the last 2,000 to 5,000 years as humans. You know, it's sort of the physiology of our brains and these kinds of things really, really haven't changed all that much. But so it's very easy for us to sort of look back on the ancient world and say, you know, people were really different then. And so they must have read really differently. So it's sort of this tangible outgrowth of othering people in the ancient world, in my opinion.
Yeah, when I first heard about this book, you were telling me about it in Salzburg a couple summers ago at the International Society of Biblical Literature, and when we were out for drinks, you were talking about the book, and I realized I immediately fell for one of the traps that you address very early on, which is related to this issue of reading and it being different from us, and specifically the myth of reading out loud. And my immediate reaction when you mentioned this was, oh, yeah, there's this, you know, quote in Augustine's Confessions about Ambrose reading yep. silently and all this. And that's like page one of that chapter. You just address that head on. So tell us what that issue is and how that idea got perpetuated.
Yeah, and in page one of the book, in fact, so this is the very the very first chapter, the thing that I open the book with. The myth that is addressed in that chapter is that people always or usually read aloud. And as you mentioned, the sort of exhibit A, or the main point of evidence for this is some kind of anecdote about Augustine and Ambrose. And people will trot this out oftentimes, or will evoke it, and maybe not recognize or not remember the details of what happens in that account. So what Augustine tells us is that he and his fellow pupils would come upon their teacher, Ambrose, sometimes in his studies. And Ambrose would sort of continue on reading silently even when his pupils came and saw him. And Augustine is sort of expresses some shock at this, you know, that he would just continue on reading silently while all of these people are around. So the train of the logic is that Augustine is actually shocked that Ambrose has this unique ability to read silently. And therefore, because Augustine is shocked that Ambrose has this unique ability to read silently, that this must have been something that people could not or did not do. But in the account, Augustine doesn't indicate that his shock is actually at the fact that Ambrose reads silently. He doesn't say anything about Ambrose's unique ability to read silently. In my opinion, the shock is more about the social context, that Ambrose would continue to go on doing this even when all of these other people are around. And the sort of linchpin for this for me is later on in the very famous Tolle Lege account, where Augustine comes upon Romans 13 and sort of his conversion experience, he picks up and reads in silence the book. He very explicitly says, "I read it in silence." So Augustine must not have been shocked at Ambrose's ability to read silently when he tells us that he himself is able to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was really convincing. And you also brought up some of the kind of like scientific side of this in terms of the way that in order to read out loud, we actually have to internally read first. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Is that the ability to read aloud presumes the ability to read silently. So if you're going to read any text out loud, but particularly if you're going to vocalize a long discourse, you have to be scanning ahead in the text in order to declaim what you have read. So you have to look ahead and do that silently. You don't look ahead and sort of just naturally vocalize what your eyes are upon in that moment. There's sort of this sort of ocular processing that happens. Your eyes are on one place, you take in the information in your brain, and then you read it aloud while you continually scan ahead in the text.
Yeah, so this is the first myth that you address. You've got one per chapter. Would you say that this is the most controversial myth, or is there another one that you think that's more controversial?
Yeah, I would say that it's at least the most common myth, and probably the most controversial because it is the most common. That it's sort of one that that just comes to mind immediately, or is sort of such a basic assumption that it may seem controversial, But then when you look at the sort of just wealth of literary evidence, it becomes really not all that controversial. It's just simply that it's a common myth.
Yeah. Is this the one that you would say is the myth that's the most demonstrably false?
Yeah, I would say that's, yes, that's, I think that's exactly the case, that it is, we can very easily sort of trot out, you know, literally hundreds of examples of people in antiquity reading silently or stating that they read silently. So you can sort of just put the texts right out there, and in a way the texts do the work of debunking this myth for you. Because it is so abundantly clear and it is so sort of baldly stated in so many places that persons read silently to themselves.
Now, I was wondering while I was reading your book, given the nature of the way you set it up, where, you know, you're talking about reading, writing, and circulating in kind of this succession, and the kind of culminating chapter is a chapter on the Gospels. And I was wondering if at any point while you were writing this, or perhaps as an idea for a future project, if you were interested in expanding the book beyond the Gospels to, like, biblical media, for example, and looking at other types of media in the New Testament, that sort of thing. Obviously, as you described, you know, this stems out of research you were doing for your dissertation, and so naturally it makes sense as an extension of that. But at any point were you thinking like, oh, this goes beyond gospel media, perhaps, and maybe there's another project here, or maybe I could write more chapters. I'm curious about that sort of inner workings of the project behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's a really great question, and I think in a way you noted the sort of structure of the book is that each of the three parts have either two or one chapters on sort of these phenomena in Greco-Roman antiquity and in Second Temple Judaism. So two chapters on reading in these settings, followed by one on situating the Gospels within those contexts. Same thing for writing, two chapters on modes of writing in Greco-Roman antiquity and Second Temple Judaism, one on the Gospels, and then in the third part, just one chapter on circulating and publishing texts, and then one on the Gospels. So there's a way in which those sort of what we might call the sort of like background chapters could be almost like a plug-and-play approach to any other literature in the New Testament, so any other genres within the New Testament. So I think it's sort of equally applicable to something like Paul's letters, that Paul's letters were very likely read in multiple different kinds of ways. And even an individual letter might be read in different kinds of ways at different times. You know, so an individual could have picked up something like Galatians or a copy of Galatians and read it to themselves, just as Galatians was probably read aloud in certain contexts. So all that to say, yes, I think the work on the mechanics of reading, writing, and circulating texts is applicable to other genres. So then it changes a little bit when it comes to something like letters and letter collections, particularly with respect to publication and circulation, because letters are sort of, in their essence, something different in what they do. So the exception there might be letters with respect specifically to publication and circulation, but I do very much think that this work can be expanded to other genres of the New Testament. And in fact, a lot of the work that I'm doing right now does have to do with the Apostle Paul. So I have an article coming out in New Testament Studies later on this year that argues that Paul both dictated texts and also wrote letters in his own hand. So my particular article in New Testament Studies will be, I argue the thesis that Philemon was written entirely in Paul's hand. And that sort of the convention of writing a personal letter and some of the rhetoric Paul uses with respect to his own hand near the end of the letter indicates that, or it is most likely the case that the entirety of Philemon would have been a Pauline autograph. So I'm sort of moving towards and looking towards how some of these, the mechanics of reading, writing, and circulating text, how they might bear out within Pauline studies.
I was very interested in this question while I was reading your book, so I'm glad to hear about this article, and congratulations. I look forward to reading it, but it was something I was thinking about a lot, especially in chapters 4 and 5, those writing, as you say, background chapters in building up to the Gospels chapter, because I was curious about those places in Paul where he does refer to his own handwriting. You mention, you know, that when there's reference to a final greeting in one's hand, that often indicates some type of dictation. And that's consistent with things like Jeffrey Wima and Randy Richards and others. People have talked about this. And I was curious because there is that interesting quote from Plutarch about the large letters in his own hand, which, of course, for a Galatians scholar, makes me think of the end of Galatians chapter 6:11. I was curious if you could say more. So do you think, like, let's say Galatians, for example, do you think there's signs of dictation prior to 6:11?
This is a really good question, and I don't know yet. I hope to know someday.
I have one possible place that I'd be curious to know. So in chapter 2, when he's reporting about what's going on in Jerusalem, he like kind of fumbles over his words, or at least doesn't complete his sentences, when he's talking about Titus and whether or not he was circumcised, you know, and he says that he wasn't, but when he starts to talk about these false brothers in 2:4, he completely interrupts himself and then starts a whole new sentence. And I'm wondering, could that be a sign of dictation, just based upon some of the things that you've studied?
Yeah, that's it. I think it could be. I mean, we have a similar thing in 1 Corinthians, right? Like, I baptized these folks. Oh, and wait, actually, yes. Also these two.
That's a great example. So
this shows up every so often. And it could be. It could be a sign of sort of dictation happening and then Paul's sort of mind catching up or going back. But this kind of thing also happens in writing, you know. And there's a way in which writing by hand is, you can sort of edit yourself more quickly. And then we also have to think about sort of the materials on which these things are being written. You know, if the initial draft is already ink on papyrus, you know, it's harder to go back and sort of amend that. And so you have to offer the correction in writing itself, whether that be, you know, the author, Paul, writing the correction out, or whether it even be the scribe taking dictation using ink and papyrus and, you know, having written what was said and then writing back down Paul's correction. But if you have something, if you have an initial draft, which was actually, this would be more common, written first on a wax tablet, you can very easily, you know, scratch out the wax, smooth out the wax, and start over. So all that to say, I don't really know what to make of those. Like, I think they're probably revealing of something, but I just don't know. I just don't know what yet.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you have this article on Philemon, because you do talk about how personal letters are more likely to be handwritten, and that if it's not, there's like some kind of embarrassment or there's an excuse that's explicitly mentioned, like, oh, here's why I had to dictate this. I'm so sorry, but, you know, whatever. And I've always lumped that reference in Philemon, what is it, verse 19, to Paul's own handwriting. I've always lumped it in with the other references to Paul's handwriting as an example of a kind of final sign-off. But as you say, if it's typical of personal letters, et cetera, and it being so short too, I mean, not necessarily so short relative to other letters in antiquity, but, you know, relative to other things that Paul has written or dictated or whatever, that it would make more sense that he might do it himself. And especially, of course, his social situation at the time as well. perhaps.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That it is a shorter letter. And oftentimes we get the idea that writing particularly long letters was an onerous task, and it was certainly a more onerous task than writing a long letter or typing a long letter today. But I do also think that Paul would have had the capability to handwrite longer letters. Whether or not he did so is an open question, and there's sort of a lot of work on the role of scribes and the sort of social position of scribes, and you know, whether Paul is many scribes were, you know, enslaved laborers, whether Paul is using enslaved laborers in the scribal process. But Philemon is, you know, of course, significantly shorter than any other Pauline letter, which makes it in some ways more an easier letter to write. The other thing that's notable about Paul's mention of his hand in Philemon, you said something like, you know, you lump them in with the other places where he mentions his hand in his letters. What is unique about Philemon and also about Galatians is that the mention of his hand comes earlier in those two texts than it does in all the other occasions in which he mentions his hand. In all the other occasions he mentions his hand, it's in the final greetings. And he'll say something like, the greeting is in my hand, and be very explicit that it's the greeting in his hand. And to me, that's a strong clue that it's just the greeting that's in his hand in those letters. But in Galatians and Philemon, it comes earlier, and it is not explicit that it's the greeting that is in his hands, which might imply that there's a lot more that is in his hand. I certainly think so for Philemon, but also for Galatians. It opens the possibility that before Galatians 6, Paul is writing in his own hand.
Very interesting. Well, I'd love to talk more about that, but I want to get back to the Gospels, as that's the focus of your book. I think the thing I found most interesting was identifying Mark as good news, Matthew as a book, Luke as an account, and John as a document. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, thank you for that. So in each of the four canonical Gospels, we have them being sort of self-conscious about what kind of document they are. Three of these come at the beginning of the Gospels, and one comes at the end. So Mark 1:1 calls itself good news, euangelion. And this word, good news or euangelion, before the Gospel of Mark, and as far as I can tell, without exception, is used of words that are spoken, not of words that are written. So it's orally proclaimed good news. And so in my estimation, Mark is sort of a go-between and is sort of explicit about this by calling itself a gospel, you know, saying it is orally proclaimed news, but it's in writing. You know, that you are reading the writing of orally proclaimed news. So Mark, from the very beginning, from Mark 1:1, calls itself the good news about Jesus. Matthew uses a different word. Matthew opts, presuming Matthew is looking at Mark 1:1, opts to remove the word euangelion. Gospel is gone from Matthew 1:1, and it becomes book. And in Greek, it's biblos. And my argument with respect to Matthew is that the word biblos in particular, especially when it's used with respect to traditions about Israel, sort of automatically connotes something scriptural. That when this term is used, especially in Second Temple Judaism and the likes of Philo and Josephus, when they use this word, they're most often referring to scripture. So that I think that Matthew sort of has high ambitions for itself, and is trying to put itself sort of on, if not even playing field, close to even playing field with what Matthew, whatever Matthew would have considered scripture in their context. So Matthew calls itself a book in 1:1, and then Luke does something different. It doesn't directly call itself an account. It sort of does so in a sort of roundabout way, but it uses a literary preface to do so. And it uses a literary preface that is addressed to an individual reader whose name is Theophilus. And by most counts of Lucan scholarship, Theophilus is in fact a real person. Or there's no real reason to suggest that Theophilus is not a real person, whether he is, you know, sort of Luke's financer or something like this, but he's a real guy out there. But so Luke is uniquely addressed to an individual reader. And so in that chapter, I look closely at other literary prefaces like Luke's that are addressed to individual readers. And what we find is normally when those prefaces are addressed to individual readers, those individual readers were the first readers of that work. And so I take that seriously with respect to Luke and think that Luke was written for an individual reader. And then finally, we have the Gospel of John, which does not say anything about sort of the kind of document that it is in chapter one in the prologue, but it does at the end in two different places. And it uses a word that's really close to book, but is not quite book. So Matthew uses biblos, the Greek word for book, whereas John calls itself a biblion, which is, in my opinion, a more generic term. It's sort of a more catch-all. So I translate it as a document. And what John does when it refers to itself as a document, it says, you know, I think it is implying that this is one document amidst other documents about Jesus that have already been written up. So I think I think John is familiar with at least one of the other synoptic gospels, Mark, but probably also the others, if not directly using those gospels, is at least familiar with them and is sort of indicating when it calls itself a document that it is another document entering into an already sort of established written tradition that consists of different kinds of documents, different media forms. And John is sort of trying to make its own way or make its own space within that environment, which maybe at three documents is starting to get a little bit crowded.
Well, I really enjoyed this part of the book, and it made me want to ask a number of follow-up questions about the implications of this, what this might help us solve within gospel scholarship, what it doesn't help us solve, or what it might just sort of supplement or, you know, come alongside of. One of those questions is how this pertains to genre. What does the media of the four gospels do or not do with the issue of, you know, is this a sui generis category gospel? Is it... Are these Greco-Roman biographies? Are they something else? Should we not actually try and say that they are one thing, but actually, because you know, in multiple places refer to them as four different things, should we actually insist that these are like four different things?
Yeah, that is a really, really fantastic question. I'm careful in the book to distinguish, and you have here accurately represented what I've done, distinguish between media and genre, that I do not think of media and genre as the same thing. So at the end of the day, what I think understanding the Gospels as different media does with respect to genres is it just further complicates it. I don't, at least in the book, I don't say that, you know, understanding Mark as a gospel genre or as a gospel gospel in its form as media, or understanding Matthew as book in its form as media, does not necessarily imply that all of the gospels or one individual gospel is a biography or a sui generis kind of thing or something else. And this is because different genres can exist in different media, or this, I should say, the same genre can exist in different kinds of media. You know, you can have a romance comedy in film, in television, in in graphic novel and book. So genre in a way sort of extends beyond media. An individual genre can be represented in different kinds of media forms. So media doesn't dictate a particular genre and vice versa. A particular genre does not necessarily imply one single kind of media. So the short of it is, I think it just really sort of complicates further the question of genre with respect to the Gospels.
Right. So with Matthew, for example, as you note in your conclusion, you use the language of Matthew rejects the word gospel in favor of book. Or I should say euangelion, right? The good news. So should we then not call Matthew a gospel to respect his intentions? Or do we need to just be very clear that when we talk about gospel as media, that's different from gospel as genre?
Yeah. You know, I don't think we need to get rid of referring to the four gospels as the four gospels or as gospels. You know, we are inheritors of that tradition that came relatively quickly after these four documents were written. So I think we've inherited that tradition in such a way that there's no going back from it, as it were. And I don't know that Matthew himself would be sort of all that upset that we call it a gospel, that we call the work that they made a gospel. But I think they would maybe prefer if we were sort of precise in our terminology with respect to what they were using or what they did use, namely Biblos or book.
Well, now I'm also curious about how Luke begins his preface with reference to the other accounts. And at one point you mentioned that the verbs that are used suggest that they are subliterary. And that's really interesting for me for a couple of reasons, because you connect it directly to Mark and what Luke thought Mark was. The connection there makes a lot of sense, because if Mark is, you know, initially part of this oral tradition that is then textualized, etc., as you talk about in the circulating chapters, you know, it's not meant for this sort of like wide circulation, and we can get to that. But this idea of what Luke has before him as being subliterary, I'm wondering, does that actually provide some evidence, or does it have any implications for whether Luke used Matthew? Because if Luke's saying everything before him is subliterary, but Matthew is actually, you know, literaturizing Mark and presenting itself as a biblos, is that Luke also saying, right, if you think Luke used Matthew, that Matthew is subliterary? Or is this actually perhaps evidence that Luke did not use Matthew? Maybe it's too subtle, but I'm curious about the implications.
Yeah. I mean, I think there. I don't think it solves the synoptic problem. You know, that's. I have not done that in this book by any stretch of the imagination. But I think there are two possibilities. One is that if Luke is sort of throwing shade here at his predecessors, that he's throwing shade at what he knows to be Mark, or at least maybe throwing shade is a little bit too strong. Maybe he's sort of updating Mark. If he recognizes that Mark is meant for some other mode of circulation or some other mode of reading, that it works for its purpose, and this is exactly what I think about Mark. But so it could be that Luke is sort of doing that shade throwing at Mark and the other document that he has in front of him, whether it be Q, which in a way I'm not a two source apologist. but if we imagine Luke to have two sources in front of him, something that is more likely to be subliterary is something that looks like Q than is Matthew.
Right.
But that's not to say that Luke couldn't well have Matthew in mind and also throwing shade at Matthew and saying, you know, Matthew thinks it's all that. But in fact, it is still sort of like, you know, he has undertaken to do this, but he hasn't succeeded the way that I have. Mm-hmm. You know, and this all brings in a lot of work that has been done in the last 5 years or so. I think of especially of Chris Keith's work mm-hmm. on competitive textualization, that sort of does Luke understand himself to be sort of competing with other gospels or other Jesus documents? And what are those other Jesus documents with which Luke and Matthew and John, for that matter, might be competing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So speaking about the textual competition, could you say a little bit about John's colophons? At the end of chapter 20 and chapter 21, there are these interesting references. This is where the kind of awareness of John's sort of context within book culture and media culture really comes through. Could you say something about that as it pertains to textual competition?
Yeah, so we have these two places at the end of John. The first one in John 20:31, where the author says that these things are written, that is, the things that are written in this document, that's this Biblion, so that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing you have may have life in his name. So it could be the case that John here is saying that these things are written so that you might believe, because the other things are not engendering belief, you know, as this document does. That this document that I have created sort of really gets it right and really helps to like spur on that belief, to hold to certain things, to certain understandings, certain understandings about Jesus. So there could be a tinge of sort of competition in there, or it could simply be that John is saying, you know, I have these things are written so that you might believe, just as the other things are written, that you might believe. And the second colophon, I think, maybe supports that sort of second notion a little bit more. And you know, then there's debates on, you know, on the nature of these colophons and how they're related to one another, and of course whether they're written by, you know, by the author of John or the original author of John. But the second one is a little bit more apologetic, and this is where I said earlier it sort of is trying to like make John appears to sort of trying to be making space for itself. In John 21:25, the colophon, and these are the last words of the Gospel of John. There are also many other things that Jesus did, and if everyone were written down, I suppose that the world could not contain the books that that were written. So here we have, like, you know, if everything was written down, we can't write everything down. There's mm-hmm. there's just so much about Jesus that it can't all be written down. And so I can write more, you know, I can, even though we already have these other things, and this is where I think John betrays knowledge of written Jesus traditions, and has sort of an apologetic, that is an apology for itself, nature to it here. That's trying to say, you know, because there's so much space for Jesus stuff, I can enter into this competitive textual fray as it were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that reading, as opposed to the idea that John is trying to shut down gospel traditions, as if to say, like, we're done now, let's stop doing this. Could you say something about that interpretation of the colophon?
That's where I'm at. I'm totally sort of on board with, you know, John making space for itself and not trying to shut down, and not trying to say, you know, these other written Jesus traditions shouldn't exist. So a term that James Barker uses that I really like is gospel proliferation. That he sees John as a gospel proliferation, a sort of an addition to what is already there, not an attempt to sort of shut down what has come before in a sort of competitive kind of way. But I should know also that when people speak of competitive textualization, they don't always mean it in such a way that is competitive in an antagonistic way.
Yeah.
Competition doesn't always have to be antagonistic. It can be, we can have gospel proliferation, something else entering into the environment, and the competition is simply for which one is read at a given point in time.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your circulating and publication chapters, you talk about Mark as notes, and you make some distinctions there about other types of literature texts that might be ready for wider publication. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And then specifically, how does that relate to its media designation as a euangelion? If it's notes and euangelion. Just love to hear more about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the word for notes here is hupanemata in the plural, or hupanema in the singular. And what this type of document was, it was variegated in form. There are all kinds of different hupanemata, and the word really has a wide, wide range. But the way that I understand notes to be relevant, particularly to the Gospel of Mark, is a specific use of notes that was largely for sort of intramural circulation, particularly in sort of a teaching setting, where a document was created oftentimes from an oral teaching environment, where a teacher, you know, said things orally, students took down sort of the notes of the things that were said and passed them around within their community or within their school or whatever it might be. So in this way, the notes are circulated and they're used by other persons, but they're not meant, or they're not created with an eye to being circulated beyond that group. That there's sort of an in-group nature to notes in this usage of the word. So that's what I have in mind with respect to Mark. And so notes and gospel are sort of connected in that way, insofar as oftentimes the word notes or hupanemata implied an oral setting, just as the word gospel implies something that is oral. And so then the sort of the opposite of this, or a different category, would be compositions, in Greek syngrammata. And these are things that were generally intended from their outset, from their conception, to go beyond a small circle or a school setting and reach a wider public. And usually a wider unknown or anonymous public, that the author is thinking beyond the people or the audience with which they are already familiar.
You know, you articulate that this means, right, that Mark is intended for limited circulation. And that got me really curious about the ending of Mark and how that debate sometimes goes. Because one of the things that is said about the ending of Mark is that maybe rather than being a great, clever ending, which is my view, I think it's brilliant, ending at, to be clear for everyone listening, ending at Mark chapter 16, verse 8, with the women running away afraid without a narration of the resurrection. I really like that ending. But one of the ideas is that, you know, hey, Mark isn't Quentin Tarantino. You know, he doesn't have our modern narrative sensibilities and avant-garde preferences for storytelling. So maybe Mark is just unfinished, right? Maybe Mark just hasn't been completed. What do you think about that idea? You do talk about the abruptness of the beginning and the ending of Mark in that chapter, but I'm curious about that particular interpretation of what's going on with Mark, that it's actually unfinished, and how might that relate to both its circulation being limited and this idea that it's notes?
So we do have this phenomenon of oral traditions and oral narratives sort of beginning in medea res. Like they just start in the middle of the thing. They just jump in to the story. They don't do a sort of lot of background. And we see this even in the way that we tell stories today. We sort of just jump into what the story is, jump into the action. And that's essentially what we get with the Gospel of Mark. And we get similarly a very, very abrupt ending. In the, you know, the so-called original ending at Mark 16:8. And like you, I do prefer that this ending being sort of an intentional rhetorical move. And I think it is particularly effective in in an oral retelling. You know, you watch something like Dr. Phil Ruge Jones or Max MacLean, who do performances of the Gospel of the Mark, and they end at the original ending. And when they do, it retains its power sort of in that oral performative mode. So I think that might be telling of sort of like the intention of ending Mark at Mark 16:8. But at the same time, Mark is unfinished insofar as other authors did come along later and finish the Gospel of Mark. So whether, you know, even if Mark intends to leave us with some cliffhanger at Mark 16:8, and that is sort of effective and does something, which I think is correct, nonetheless, it was not satisfying to authors very early on who decided that they did need to finish the Gospel of Mark. So I think we could hold sort of both of those together, that, you know, that on the one hand, Mark 16:8 does something effectively, and nonetheless, it remains unfinished and gets finished by other authors.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. There's another proposal which I don't buy, but it's a media related proposal, which is that the idea that actually we've lost the ending of Mark because of like a fire or something like that, and maybe we lost the beginning too. And there's a specific media articulation of this, that perhaps, you know, as the text is rolled up, that the front and the back end are what got burned up, and that explains the abruptness of the beginning and the end. Do you have anything that you'd like to say about that as it relates to the material form of the media?
Yeah, I mean, I don't buy the idea that sort of Mark was mutilated, as it were, and by natural causes or intentional human causes. I don't think it's a satisfying explanation. I think, you know, when Mark gets written down, we are probably to imagine several copies existing early on, that the sort of, it's hard for me to believe that the sort of fragility of this new written tradition would be so fragile, so as to sort of lose the beginning and ending, and then just be like, well, that's it. Like, now we're going to continue on with the law, reproducing this text sort of with its lost beginning and ending. But it's an interesting question, because one of the other things that I engage in part three is the question of whether the Gospels were circulated in rolls or codices. And, you know, with respect to, in a way, for both codices and for rolls, the beginning and endings are the most vulnerable places. And we see this borne out sort of in the material history of texts in antiquity, that these are the spaces that often do sort of get lost most often for one reason or another. So there's a way in which it's a plausible explanation, but I just don't think it's the most plausible.
Well, perhaps as a final question, where is this research taking you next? Do you have other projects in mind that extend this area of book culture and media?
Yeah, it's all sort of preliminary, but I am hoping to move into a Pauline project on similar ideas and themes. Very tentative title at this point is called Paul Among the Literati. And it's will engage similar questions about sort of how Paul engaged reading, writing, and circulating letters, but particularly with respect to how we ought to situate Paul within the literary landscape and literary circles in Greco-Roman antiquity and Second Temple Judaism. So are we to think of Paul as sort of a highfalutin literary figure amongst the Plinys and the Ciceros? Or are we to think of Paul sort of more literary, and his literacy being with respect to his business affairs? I think we have a lot of signs of sort of Paul's business literacy coming into what would be sort of his literary compositions. You know, there is a way in which Paul's letters are sort of highly literary insofar as they are engaging antecedent texts in the form of the Septuagint. They're doing all kinds of sophisticated things, but they're also sort of for the purpose of something, namely Paul's ministry, which Paul probably would have had to have a number of literacy skills that were related to buying and selling, running businesses, this kind of thing that I think show up quite often in the letters. So that's sort of where I'm moving next, is toward understanding Paul within his literary and literacy circles.
Well, that sounds fantastic. And of course, we'll have to have you back on the pod to talk about it. But Dr. Elder, thank you so much for joining us. This was a fantastic conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.